Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Stephanie Curtis.
I'm Ewan Kerr.
And we are the Cube Critics. And Ewan, we're here for a full hour.
Seriously?
Yes. We have a jam-packed show about the latest movies and issues in the movies.
We also will talk about a couple of big films opening this week, The Girl on the Train and Birth of a Nation.
That second movie has been stirring up a lot of discussion about the portrayal of African-American stories in the movies, and we'll discuss that with some national experts, and we'll also want your input.
And finally, we'll talk with two filmmakers who are touring Minnesota with their documentary, Men in the Arena. It's the story of two young men on Somalia's national soccer team and the struggles they face as their homeland recovers from 3 decades of civil war.
But first, let's talk about the big titles opening in a theater near you. Which do you want to start with, Ewan? Why don't we start with Birth of a Nation?
Indeed.
All right. What did you think?
Birth of a Nation, well, this is a much-anticipated film.
It is.
Looking at the Nat Turner rebellion, mm-hmm. where many, many people died, slave rebellion, hundreds of years ago.
1830s.
So it's a brutal film. You can't take your eyes away from it, but I have to admit, I felt it was a little lacking.
Yeah. So this is, Nate Parker wrote, produced, directed. I mean, he did everything on this. This was a passion project of his.
And starred.
He's a great actor. And it opened at Sundance Film Festival, and it opened last season during Sundance. It was a big deal. And I think he just took on so much, and a lot of the film is depicting of day-to-day life as a slave and Nat Turner's day-to-day life, and not as much about the rebellion. And it dragged a little in parts, and he had a hard time getting a good rhythm. And then Nat Turner also, the actual man, had visions of himself. He had been a man as a young child, he had felt singled out as especially beloved, and his community thought he was a chosen one, and he had visions then,
and also clearly he had skills as a preacher.
Yeah. And Nate Parker wanted to get those visions in the film, and they didn't quite work. He didn't. I don't know if it's his skills as a director or if it was in the screenwriting, but that reaching for those mystical images and incorporating it into the reality of life as a slave didn't quite work for me. And then also just things like the soundtrack was really overly romantic. And there are a lot of cliches. You know, if someone picks up a handkerchief and coughs, when it pulls down, they're going to be coughing up blood. When a woman is alone and bends over and then a camera comes swooping in behind her, you know she's going to be attacked by some men. There are just a lot of things that were film cliches in there. And it's not a horrible movie. It was not the epic, the great movie that I was hoping it would be.
I'm not entirely sure what I would have done to have changed this, but it seemed to kind of lack context is the wrong word. It just stops. There is, and maybe that is true of the story, and that here was this build up to this very bloody rebellion, and then an even bloodier aftermath where hundreds of people were killed in retribution for this slave uprising, and then you're kind of waiting for. And after having seen all this, you're kind of left wondering a little about it all.
Right.
It's a horrible depiction of what happens in slavery. I mean, I didn't find that part dragged for me at all. I mean, there are moments where the audience I was with was gasping, and actually not necessarily the moments that you might expect. I mean, there is they're very bloody, you know, whippings and things like that. But there were other parts in the film where you could hear just the intake of breath. And So I thought that was actually very effective, but it then just kind of got lost.
And Nate Parker as an actor is a powerful presence. And the other thing that I really liked about it was there were some moments that were humorous, that where there was the, where the audience just cracked up. That was really humor in the horror of slavery or somebody talking back, and that was really well done. Anyway, so we're going to talk a lot about it, no doubt. So also, Girl on a Train opened based on a best-selling book by, what's her name?
Paula Hawkins.
Paula Hawkins, a book that I didn't really like that much. I was not looking forward to the movie, so I'm glad that you saw it instead of me.
Now,
how's
I
the movie?
Well, I have not read the book, so all the twists and turns in it came as a complete surprise.
Well,
and
good for you. I can't remember the twists and turns, so I would have been surprised too.
It's the story of this woman who takes a commuter train. The book was originally set in London, but this is actually set in New York, and this train is going up to the kind of the suburbs along the Hudson Valley. And she witnesses something. She's actually has made a point of staring into a couple of specific houses, and we learn why as the story goes on. And so it's always a trial here. How much do you reveal? But Emily Blunt plays Rachel, the central character, the girl on the train, who, as it turns out, has an extraordinarily serious drinking problem. And there is one of the women she has been spying on as she goes by in this train disappears. And she, because she's been drinking so heavily and has had blackouts, she begins to wonder if she is responsible for whatever has happened to this woman. And in many ways, I mean, Emily Blunt is amazing.
I always love watching her.
She's a great actor, and she plays this character who is deeply, deeply troubled, and you feel the pain. There are so many twists and turns, and there's a certain amount of jumping backwards and forwards in time as the story unfolds, which occasionally I found got a little confusing. Hmm. I mean, I worked it all out in the end, but I thought it was actually a very effective portrait of what some women in, you know, abusive relationships go through, what some women who are deeply alcoholic go through too. It's not a world changing movie. My life is not going to be any different as a result of seeing this. It's very effective. I was also interested to see hugely female audience at the screening I went to. So, and I don't know, maybe that was who they were handing out the tickets to, but it was quite striking.
All right, well, we'll no doubt clean up at the box office.
Yes.
If everyone who bought one of those books, it's still in the top 10 after years. It's been out for like over a year now. So if everyone who bought a book, bought a ticket, they're going to make a lot of money. Congratulations, whoever made that film. Good for you. Now let's go in depth on African Americans in Hollywood.
To watch a strong man broken down is a terrible thing.
Lord's spoken to me. Visions of what's to come. A rise of good against evil.
What are we going to do?
We'll fight. Once it begins, our brothers and sisters will join. And we'll number in the hundreds, thousands even.
When it screened at Sundance, Birth of a Nation was greeted with standing ovations and awards. Written, produced, directed, and starring African-American Nate Parker, it was seen as a sign of salvation for Hollywood during last year's Oscar so white season.
It's not just Oscars that are so white. It's most of Hollywood films. The Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies has an annual report on diversity in Hollywood, and it found minorities lost ground last year. They are outnumbered 3-1 in film leads, 3-1 among film directors, 5-1 among writers. So how are we still here in 2016? And while this applies to all minority groups, today we are talking specifically about African Americans in film. If you're African American, share your thoughts about how blacks are portrayed by Hollywood at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 8. What film about black life or African-American history is a favorite of yours? You can also go to nprnews.org/live.
Joining us now are Erica Howard, the marketing manager at Women Make Movies, and Gil Robertson, the president of the African-American Film Critics Association. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Gil, if we could start with you, just generally, how have your members been responding to Birth of a Nation?
You know, we've chosen to judge the movie on its own merit. Obviously, there's been a separate controversy that really has nothing to do with the movie involving, Nate, and given his status as a principal character, and to your point earlier, he's all over the place in this project, the two have kind of gotten intertwined. But our members are, we've decided as a collective to look at the movie purely on its own merit. And I think the general consensus is that it's a good first effort. I agree with you that it's not a great movie, but it's certainly a movie that I think that people should, that audiences should go out and see and decide for themselves. I mean, it speaks to a very relevant and important part of our nation's history, and it's certainly a story worth telling.
Erica, we should ask you, have you had a chance to see the film, and do you have any thoughts?
I haven't had a chance to see the film, but I do plan on seeing it soon.
Great.
Yeah, when people asked me whether I would, no, I had to go see it, but I really truly believe in separating an artist from their art and seeing it on its own merits, so I'm glad that your association decided on that. What films have you seen this year that you've been really impressed by, you two?
I have to say, in terms, I'm sorry.
ladies first.
Go, Erica.
Thank you. I saw earlier a documentary, O.J. Simpson Made in America, directed by Ezra Edelman. The film was distributed by ESPN. I think it did a really thorough and really great job of taking really important issues and putting it in its historical context to help people have a much more informed understanding of the genesis of certain circumstances and problems, and then providing a way to help go forward in current conversations.
I haven't seen that yet. I saw the TV. Did you watch the TV movie based on it also, the one with Cuba Gooding Jr.?
No, I didn't see that one. I just saw the documentary.
Okay. Les in Minneapolis called, and this is probably a question for Gil. He says, they never mentioned the original Birth of the Nation film. That means we didn't. He wanted to know how they compare to one another and the comparison between the D.W. Griffith classic and the Nate Parker film. What did you think of him taking on that title for the new movie?
Well, I think the only thing classic about the original one was the fact that it got made at all, that it was sort of a first step, utilizing, the technology, and that's what makes it, made it relevant and still keeps it in the conversation. There were a lot of, certainly the African-American community and others were very, very put off by that film, which many perceived to be heavy with, racial stereotypes and just kind of backward imagery. I think that was Nate's point in naming his film, after that, to sort of draw some sort of correlation between, just the differences. One is about subjugation of a people, whereas the other one is, could be said that it's about the empowerment of a people. I'm not really sure what, I didn't go to TIFF this year. I know some of my members did, and I'm sorry, I didn't go to Toronto Film Festival this year, but we were present. But from the feedback that I've gotten, it was basically just sort of like a play on the Griffith title.
I think there has been a certain amount of confusion, though. People have gone some people have gone wondering if it is a remake.
Right. Wouldn't that be funny?
Yeah.
This is probably a question for you, Erica. Have you seen the new documentary 13th? That is a question somebody online is looking forward to.
Right. Unfortunately, I actually almost had the opportunity to see it last weekend, but ultimately was not able to. Ava DuVernay was here in New York for the New York Film Festival, in which her film was the first documentary to ever open the New York Film Festival. But the discussion around it is very important. I am planning to see it, and I think it's one that has been very much in the conversation for the last couple of years, of the idea that slavery ended with the 13th Amendment, only to find that there's this loophole, this crucial loophole, that basically it's through the punishment of crime that slavery can still exist. And taking a look at the depth of that and how that's reverberating through, you know, all these years later to the mass incarceration of African American men and what that means. I think it's a very relevant film. I think it's a force to be reckoned with in terms of the subject matter and what it's going to create in terms of how to address this problem.
Jeff has a comment online at nprnews.org/live. He says, Luke Cage is pretty good on Netflix. It's about a superhero who lives in Harlem and takes on organized crime. It's pretty interesting so far. The music is great, and all but a handful of characters are non-black. Blackish is one of the best shows on TV right now. The most recent episode was pointedly about politics and how some individuals will vote for a political party because they always have, instead of looking at their own stances on political issues. Do you both feel like Hollywood filmmaking is seeding the ground to TV, where TV seems to be doing better right now at depicting African-American lives than Hollywood films are? Is this, do you feel like that is the case?
Well, they certainly are this year. I mean, we've seen this story before. I've been covering film and TV for over 20 years now, and we've covered this ground before, and it's just... you know, what I think people in the black community are looking for a consistency. You know, they're not necessarily looking for, you know, everything to be lovely and positive. We want diversity in our portraits as well, but we want consistency in the delivery of those images. And so, you know, time will tell if this time it'll stick. Certainly with the shows that are currently airing, you know, from Queen Sugar to Blackish to How to Get Away with Murder to Insecure, which is still coming up via HBO. There's some positive things to say, but will it last is the big question.
We should ask people, if you have a question or comment, give us a call at 651-227-6000 or call toll-free at 800-242-2828. You can also get us online at nprnews.org/live. I didn't give you a chance to respond to Stephanie's question about TV picking up the reins.
Sure. I actually was going to echo what Gil had noted, that there is that desire to have consistency. You see it in film where there seems to be a boom in black film, and then there's a dying down of these stories. And the same goes for television, where you have, you know, a couple of programs that are really making an impact on popular culture, and then they disappear. And then you have the resurgence of someone like Shonda Rhimes, who comes along and creates all this great programming with black female leads, which is fantastic. And, you know, you have Kerry Washington, Viola Davis being seen in very prominent roles and very good depictions. And then you also have other independent voices coming along through Ava DuVernay with Queen Sugar and Issa Rae with Insecure. And the idea is, will this hold? Will there be, this is a momentum right now, but it's important that it's sustained. And it can be. I just think it's a part of whether or not people are willing. There's definitely an audience, but for those who are in the seat of producing these types of programs and funding them, will they be willing to carry these kinds of programs going forward?
That's what mystifies me, because movies will make big box office. They'll get good ratings, TV shows that have diverse casts, and Hollywood, when the media will celebrate them, and then it will dissipate, and we'll forget about it, and we'll have another couple years without awards or with a new group of of TV shows that don't have diverse casts, or with a new spate of, you know, we'll have another report from the Ralph Bunche Center where minorities are losing ground. What, isn't Hollywood a business? Why does this happen?
Yeah, I think it has to do with the insecurities. It's a huge business. There's a lot of money at stake. And I think there are definitely those who just feel very insecure about betting on these programs, even though they've been proven to be economically viable. Just even outside of African-American audiences, just in general, Hollywood is a place that wants to try and bet on the sure thing. And that's why we see the proliferation of sequels. Of the first one did well, so let's go to the next one, instead of taking that risk and investing in something that has had a different form in the past and has succeeded, but if we try it again, will it work? So I think that's part of it, is the insecurity and not wanting to take that risk.
Are there lessons to be learned from other countries, do you think, in terms of the shows, the films that are being made in similarly diverse communities, but outside the reach of Hollywood and U.S. television?
Well, I think that, American entertainment content is, leaps and bounds ahead of its European counterparts, in terms of diversity. I mean, that's a problem in and of itself, since, Europe is becoming increasingly more diverse. I think that there's been a reluctance, though, to further comment on what Erica stated, with the studios really making a firm commitment to diverse stories. I mean, this is a diverse country, and there's a belief in Hollywood that Black films or films with Black leads don't have legs or won't carry over fine box office, in international territories, which is questionable because, when you look at athletics, when you look at music, that it certainly isn't true. We just need to really, Hollywood being a town that is supposedly built on creativity is surprisingly devoid of it when it comes to being willing to take certain risks. And while certainly everyone understands, that it's a business, I think that, the Black films in particular that have been successful, over the years, over the last 20 years, let's say, prove the point that these films have the ability to attract audiences. And it's just someone having the willingness, to put it out there and to put it out there aggressively.
We'd love to hear from you right now. If you are African-American and you have a particular movie or TV show that you think really depicts African-American life well, or you have a question or comment about how African-Americans are portrayed in Hollywood, give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. And Krista went to nprnews.org/live, and she's got an interesting question about, like, when you see characters, how are they portrayed? She says, it's interesting to me that even now, when African-American characters in TV or film are given powerful leading roles, those roles are tainted with deceitful, conniving, lying, unfaithful, and even murderous characters. Olivia Pope on Scandal, Lucius Lyon and Cookie on Empire, Annalise Keating on How to Get Away with Murder. What do you folks think? What do you think, Gil or Erica? Who wants to take that on? When you see African-American characters, what kind of characterizations do you like to see?
I stated it earlier. I think most Black people in America, any place, quite frankly, are just simply looking for three-dimensional portraits of those people. We don't want them to be too good. We don't want them to be too bad. We want them to just simply be, like Harrison Ford, for instance, where he's just a guy going through a story. He's sometimes good, he's sometimes bad, but really you're getting into the complete development of who that person is, in a 360 degree way. And it's not just sort of a caricature or some sort of loose play on a stereotype. So it's definitely a problem. And again, it goes to the development process. When you look behind the camera, and you look at the teams that are developing these stories, usually what you'll find are crews, writing staffs that are devoid of diversity. And that's a problem when it comes to really crafting and developing, you know, three-dimensional portraits. So that's something that we have to work on, and it's something that Ava, in particular, has succeeded well in doing with Clean Sugar. One of the things about her show that's distinctive and noteworthy is the fact that she only hired women to direct each episode. And so you're getting a perspective that's unique and that's distinctively feminine. And it's a female-themed story, so why not? You know, why has it taken, you know, nearly 100 years for someone to finally get, hey, it's a female-themed show, why don't we hire female directors to tell it?
Exactly. I mean, I really have to, I totally agree with what Gil is saying, that it's not necessarily problematic that you have African-American characters who have these different issues that would be considered negative. It's more so of really depicting them in all of their complexity and not bringing these two dimensions, these stereotypes, these tropes that have existed all throughout the history of film and television and media. You know, speaking in terms of depictions of African-American women, there's been so many repeated tropes of the mammy character or the domestic, or the what's called the sapphire character, someone who's sassy and aggressive and labeled as being the angry black woman, or even the Jezebel, who's often over-sexualized and in scenes that show prostitutes or promiscuity. These are very negative stereotypes that have existed and persisted throughout film and television. And so when you have characters that have faults, that's one thing, but not to have someone who doesn't have a sense of self, a sense of a fullness of their character or even agency. That's really important, to depict someone with intelligence and really having a good grounding about who they are in life. I think that it's not problematic, again, that there are characters that have faults. I mean, you look at someone like the character that Denzel Washington played in Flight. Definitely someone who's riddled with faults, but someone who has redeemable characterizations, as well as you take a look at a film like Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is very unique, which you have a father figure who's faulted, who displays his rage and his sadness, but at the same time, you have an understanding that he loves his daughter and he'll do anything to help protect her and show a sense of tough love. So just like what Gil is saying, that we definitely want to see more of a 360, a three-dimensional, and not just a sort of a cardboard cutout of a characterization of a person.
We're talking about African Americans in film today. We have to take a quick break for news, and we have a couple of people on the line. We'll talk to them after we get back. But John Wanamaker, what are our lead stories today?
Hurricane Matthew. You know, and the authorities warn that the danger from that storm is far from over. The storm scraped Florida's Atlantic coast early today, bringing down trees and knocking out power to 500,000 people. However, some of the most heavily populated areas were spared the brunt of the storm. Hundreds of miles of coastline in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina is still under threat of torrential rain and dangerous storm surge. Southwestern Haiti was hit hard by Hurricane Matthew. The International Red Cross is making an emergency appeal for about $7 million to provide medical aid, shelter, water, and sanitation assistance to 50,000 people in the region. UNICEF says it needs $5 million to meet children's immediate needs there. The World Food Program says it has enough food on the ground for 300,000 people for a month, and it's deploying people to help distribute it. The Matthew storm left more than 280 dead in its wake across the Caribbean, most of those deaths occurring in Haiti. Donald Trump is saying that Border Patrol agents have been told to allow immigrants into the United States illegally so they can vote in the election. He spoke today as he received the backing of the National Border Patrol Council. A union official said agents told him that they had directives to ignore immigrants' criminal records so they can vote. Trump called it a huge story. Neither the union official nor Trump offered any evidence to back up the claim. Newly admitted immigrants are not permitted to vote. Trump has repeatedly said he fears the election will be rigged. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Hi, I'm Chris Farrell. Join me for the next Conversations on the Creative Economy on October 14th with Joanne Jenkins, CEO of AARP. We'll discuss the mission and the business of ARP. Get your tickets now by going to nprnews.org/creative economy.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, the CEO of Backpage.com was arrested yesterday. The website has been criticized for facilitating sex trafficking. So what effect might the arrest have? We'll discuss. You'll also hear from DFL Congressman Rick Nolan as we look ahead to next month's election. All of that at 11.
National Geographic Live is back at the Fitzgerald Theater on October 27th. On the trail of big cats with photographer Steve Winter in Latin American rainforests, the Himalayas, and Hollywood. Get your tickets now at FitzgeraldTheater.org.
Programming is supported by the St. James Hotel in Red Wing, a historic hotel offering spaces for corporate meetings and retreats set within the backdrop of the Mississippi River Valley. More information online at st-james-hotel.com.
You are listening to The Cube Critics this hour with Birth of the Nation opening nationwide this week. Our theme is African Americans in the movies. Our guests today are Erica Howard, she's managing manager at Women Make Movies, and Gil Robertson, the president of the African American Film Critics Association. We also want to hear from you this hour. Call 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. You can also go to our live blog, nprnews.org/live. But first, a blast from the past.
It's Hollywood's first black acting school. It teaches you everything.
Classes are enrolling now. Learn to play TV pimps, movie muggers, street punks. Courses include Jive Talk 101, Shuffling 200, Epic Slaves 400.
Black acting school!
Don't try to be cool. Call Hollywood's
first black acting school.
And Robert Townsend's Hollywood Shuffle doesn't seem that dated still today. We are talking about African Americans in Hollywood. And we've got a call from Alex in Minneapolis. And Alex wants to talk about crying in the movies. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What movies did you want to talk about?
Well, the two movies that made me really feel emotional the first time I seen them were Boys in the Hood and Miracle at St. Anna. I felt like they depicted a realistic situation in black history. And another thing is some of the movies that come out, like, say, Selma, I felt like was kind of watered down because, you know, every time I seen real-time video of it, there were fire hoses and German shepherds, and they had neither of those in the movie, you know.
You felt like it didn't depict the actual march that well?
No, not from what I've seen of real-life footage, because, you know, the two big things that always come to my mind whenever I think of that moment in history is the fire hoses and the dogs, mm-hmm. and neither of them were in the movie. So.
How old were you when you saw Boys in the Hood?
I was about 12 years old.
Oh, really?
Young. Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in, Alex.
Thank you.
Erica, what did you think of Boys in the Hood when you saw it? I assume you've seen that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. By the time I saw it, I was pretty young, too. I don't remember how old I was. But I thought it was really groundbreaking, and it depicted a segment of black life in California and the circumstances there in a very realistic way. It was raw, but at the same time, I thought it was a respectful depiction, which is very important. It showed that characters can be very complicated as they're going through their struggles, but also that they have integrity and courage. And I think it did well to be, well-rounded in that.
And Gil, when Slate came out with earlier this year, they came out with a black film canon, and Boys in the Hood was on there. Do you consider it a classic of African-American film, a classic of American film?
Oh, without a doubt. It's actually a signature movie when you think of black cinema. And, of course, its success spawned a lot of copycats, which is very typical of the industry. And is, in fact, the ultimate compliment when people copy your work. So, without doubt, what Erica stated, they were three three-dimensional characters. You know, it was just the stories, the characters, you know, had full arcs. And so, you know, it's what anyone's looking for, you know, real people that you can relate to.
We also have Sana on the line from St. Paul. Sana?
Hi. I just wanted to further the conversation about Queen Sugar. I just started viewing it, and I read the book, and initially I was a bit disturbed that the book, the novel, the movie at least, is not the same in a lot of details that we find in the novel. But what I specifically like about Queen Sugar, other than the fact that there are these female directors, is that I think there's a considerable amount of authenticity in the movie in terms of a lot of the different characters. I think it deals with some issues that we don't often see happening in movies. For instance, looking at Louisiana and the private prison system, what happens to farmers, black farmers in Louisiana and other places in the South. And besides that, in each character, you see a representation of African Americans. And so we see the broad range of our community. So I'm very impressed with what's happening with Queen Sugar. And I'd like to, the person who spoke before me, The Miracle of Santa Ana, I think, is probably one of Spike Lee's best movies. And it's a shame that a lot of people have not seen it, but it's superb.
It's an incredible book, too.
Thanks for calling, Santa. Erica, we've been talking a lot about Queen Sugar, and I was wondering what other depictions as an African-American woman have you seen recently that really spoke to you as, you know, saying, I feel like I've seen myself on screen?
Sure. Well, I would have to say in the last couple of years, there have been a number of films that I think maybe on a commercial scale have not been as recognized, but definitely in terms of the impact that they've made in the, I guess, smaller niche communities, they have. A couple of years ago, before Ava DuVernay, you know, became very well known, I'd worked with an organization that was helping to market her film Before Selma. It's called Middle of Nowhere.
Oh, I love that movie.
And, yes, absolutely. And so I helped with the New York launch of that film. And what I did was I was able to reach out to different organizations of women who have a spouse or a loved one who's incarcerated. And one of the things that they kept telling me over and over again was, A, we have never, ever seen our story depicted on the big screen, and B, it's done in such a respectful way, it's made us so proud. And I have to say that, you know, the seeds of that were incredible for me, of just being an African-American woman and being a part of presenting a film to, and it wasn't just for that audience. When people came to the theater, it was a very diverse crowd of a mixture of all kinds of people from all backgrounds. And so it really was something that was a specific film that depicted black women in a very positive way, but also was very universal, that it spoke to people, men of all backgrounds and colors and so forth. And that made a profound effect on me. I also liked other films like Fruitvale Station. Mm-hmm. I think Michael B. Jordan, also Octavia Spencer, did great jobs in that. I don't know if you saw that film, but
But tell the audience about it.
Yeah, tell them.
Oh, sure. It was made a couple years ago, before a lot of the headlines that we see today about a young unarmed black man who was fatally shot by police. And it follows his journey, but also the journey of his mother. And I loved how Octavia Spencer depicted the role of a single black mother. It just, I felt, was great and really giving what we're talking about, that authenticity, mm-hmm. and that respectful representation that is so deserved. And there's also a smaller film called American Violet that starred Nicole Beharie. This is a couple years ago, and the co-star of that was Alfred Woodard, where it's a true life story about a young mother who was falsely accused of distributing narcotics. And eventually what happens is she's put in a position where she is offered to a deal to plead guilty and serve a 10-year suspended sentence, although she wasn't in the wrong. She didn't commit this crime. And so it brought up the whole problem that's happened where African-Americans have been put in a place in the criminal justice system where they've been told you either plead guilty or you have to, you know, do some kind of plea bargain. And so it addressed different types of, you know, racial discrimination and what it's like to battle these types of odds. And I thought that Nicole Beharie did a great job.
We just got a couple of moments left here in the show, but actually we wanted to go back to the some of the ideas thrown out there. Typecasting, the Hollywood shuffle clip. Why can't we, why don't we see more black actors and actresses cast as engineers and bankers? And are there actually any film recommendations that you have where black actors aren't cast in these typical tropes?
Gil?
Oh, we don't have enough time.
Okay.
Sorry. I was thinking that was a big question to ask with 50 seconds left.
That's a huge question. What I would like to piggyback on, Erica, that, you know, this year we're seeing some great examples of stories around black men that we haven't seen before. There's a movie that did very well at Telluride in Toronto called Moonlight, which is an amazing portrait of a black man's journey through three stages of his life, from childhood to adulthood, early adulthood. Also, Luke Cage is another depiction of black male identity that is seldom seen on the big or small screen. So, you know, Hollywood is means well. I truly, you know, I've spent the last the biggest portion of my life, you know, working in covering the industry, and I think that some of the steps that we see being made now are an indicator that they are willing to try. I think what's important is for your audience members to support these efforts so that Hollywood will see that there's a benefit to making those, you know, making such investments.
Gil, I'm really sorry. It's a business. I really blew this in the timing. I'm very sorry. We have to say thank you. Thank you very much for coming on and talking to us today. We have Gil Robertson, the president of the African American Film Critics Association, and Erica Howard, the marketing manager at Women Make Movies. Thanks very much for both of you for coming in today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Finally today, we talk with two filmmakers taking their film, Men in the Arena, around Minnesota, culminating with a screening at the Parkway Theater in Minneapolis at 7 p.m. tomorrow. It's about two young men who are members of Somalia's national soccer team. As the film shows, Somalis love soccer.
And make no mistake about it, I think the number of Somali fans anywhere in the world could rival the local teams anywhere in the world.
Somalis love football. They come in hordes. They come in big numbers, and they love their team.
Director J.R. Byersmith and editor Brian Belnikov had paid little attention to Somalia in recent years. However, when they heard about attempts to reopen both of Mogadishu's soccer stadia, it seemed like a sign of hope. If the stadiums could come back, places which had been used as military bases during 30 years of civil war and as a place of punishment by the terror group Al-Shabaab, then things might be improving. Byersmith and Belnikov began what became a three-year project by traveling to Mogadishu. Belnikov said they went to meet members of the Somali national squad to look for people they could profile, and that's where they met Sadiq.
Immediately we knew there was something very special about this guy. He just had this very worldly philosophy and realized that there was more opportunity outside of Africa, and they love watching soccer in the Premier League, and that's what they want.
And we'd ask them to fill out a form too.
You're right.
Of questions, and he said, "Hey, my friend Saad has a really difficult story. Like, I think it's too hard for him to write." And that was the very first night that we realized that Saad had been captured by Al-Shabaab.
There is a very sad moment in the film where you begin to chronicle how pretty much every member, not all of them, but almost every member of the Somali national team has lost someone close to them as a result of the conflict there.
A lot of my teammates don't talk about it, but pretty much every one of them has lost family in the war. Jibril lost his mother and cousins. Hassan lost his aunt. Gese lost his father and uncle. Hayo lost his sister and uncle. I've lost a lot of friends, including my goalkeeper. Annie lost a lot of friends. Saad has not lost anyone but was arrested by Al-Shabaab.
The player was arrested and publicly whipped for playing soccer. Director J.R. Byersmith says outwardly, the Somali national team players showed no indication of trauma.
When we first met the Somali national team, you don't feel that. They have this sense of, it's like they can tuck all the pain away and present you with these smiles that are completely disarming. And, you know, as a filmmaker and a storyteller, you want to get to the heart of the emotion, you know? So, and it's almost hard to even discern, is that even there? And it took a while to ask the questions to get to that place.
There's also like a masculinity thing. It's like, you know, sure, they don't want to show vulnerability culturally. And I think with any culture that experiences a lot of tragedy, they like to find humor to get over those things. And so they were very like, they like cracking jokes all the time. So they're very happy regardless.
But it really kind of also shows the resilience of not just the members of the team, but the Somali people as a whole coming through this wretched experience.
That's when we start to peel back the layers and you realize, whoa, I mean, there's real pride around this team. I mean, every national team can find that pride. This is a resiliency pride. That's why it's called Men in the Arena. That's why it's called from the famous Roosevelt speech about just being engaged and, you know, just participating alone feels significant. And I think that is to the very root of what resiliency is. If we can find hope, we can find joy just in the being there. That's really, and you can't help but feel that right away. And we, of course, felt that with Saad and Sadiq immediately.
So what were the challenges for you as filmmakers shooting in Mogadishu and around Somalia?
How much time do you have?
A lot, I take it.
That's right, because it's really been a, how do you tell a story about a place where the archives are destroyed, where your subjects are petrified to potentially open up to you and share because the consequences are so steep? And once you get that trust, then what do you do with it? You know, how do you represent the story in the right way? And then it's, as you had mentioned, it's about two friends. Well, one friend was in Nairobi and the other friend was in Mogadishu. And in fact, most of the time outside of Mogadishu in a village called Afgoye, that I can't even, when I went into Mogadishu, I couldn't even get to him and go to Afgoye because I would have drawn attention to him. So he's already a notable figure. So if I go with him to his village, all of a sudden, like, where's this guy coming from? This isn't a local story. So there was just all these challenges in that way of how do you even get access to character? And that, I think, really was the... And then when it was, Brian could speak to for days, the editing challenge of dealing with the different dialects in Somalia. And that's where I think it comes to the Somali community here in the U.S. that was so beautiful for us is, you know, there's a young woman here in Minneapolis named Honey who helped a lot with translation. And we just loaded clips for days to YouTube and a Tumblr blog that was private. And Brian and myself and her and a couple other people in the diaspora, like we all worked together to do that translation. And it took a long, long, long time.
Yeah, I'd say, especially on the ground, it becomes a challenge where you start rolling on something and you don't know what's important. If something's saying, if someone could be saying something really impactful and we won't find out till months later when we have it translated. You just don't know.
And you also had to have protection when you're going around too. I mean, there's a lot of shots of people sitting in jeeps with large guns.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate challenge of storytelling there, is that there's a wire. So when you get to Mogadishu Airport, and then that's where AMISOM, the African Union Mission in Somalia is, that's where all the embassies that are just now starting to come back, all of them are stationed there. And then once you leave the wire, well, that's actually where you connect with people. That's where all the real life is happening. That's where the city's coming back. But the ability, because of targeted attacks, that's where it's also the most dangerous. So the juxtaposition of those two ideas is really, it's tragic too, because it's so beautiful once you're just amongst the people and the shorelines, as you see in the film. It's stunning, but it's so hard to get there and get on the ground and really grasp the true pieces of storytelling that you want to get to.
So you're here in Minnesota. You're doing several screenings, culminating with the showing at the Parkway. What are you hoping to gain from this?
I think that Somalia so often gets this single story attached to it, this single story of fear and this single story of bad. It's just been 30 years of three decades of trauma. And I think for us, it was an opportunity to let young people tell their story and be hope for a generation of young people that back in Somalia, Saad and Sadiq are really well known. Well, now they live in St. Louis, Missouri. They're not so well known here. But I think every time we get to talk about Somalia and people see the film, that's the face they associate with Somalia now. That's a big deal. I think that's how you start to shape the narrative. I mean, we can't fix a war. We can't fix years of chaos and the time that it's going to take to rebuild. But if you don't have a hero when you're growing up, what are you supposed to do? And I think that's what they represent.
In a way, though, the story is just beginning on so many levels, but particularly with Sadiq and Saad. I mean, they're young players, and they're early in their careers.
Yeah, and the fact that they live in St. Louis, Missouri now is just just blows my mind. They actually live with my sister and her husband, and Sadiq is going to St. Louis University and playing. He's starting to really learn the American way of being on the pitch. So it's fun. And Saad, you know, sat in a classroom for the first time in his entire life. Imagine that, at 23 years old, to pick up a pencil for the first time inside the classroom setting. And so it really is just beginning. And that's terribly exciting.
So more films to come then?
Oh, man. That's a great question. This one beat us up for 3 years. Catch us in 7 and we'll talk again.
G.R. Byersmith is director of Men in the Arena. He and editor Brian Belenkov will introduce the film at a screening at 7 p.m. tomorrow at the Parkway Theater in Minneapolis. So there it is, Stephanie. Another edition of The Cube Critics Hour wrapped up.
And you can sign up for our podcast. Go to nprnews.org/podcasts if you want to hear more. I hope you do.
The place where we get the timings right.
The place where we get the timings right. That's right.
Coming up in a few moments, we have Tom Weber. We'll be doing the next hour. And then stay tuned for the rest of the day with the latest on the hurricane then in the Caribbean and along Florida. Thanks very much for listening. And, Stephanie.
I wanted to say something. We talked about that Barry Jenkins movie, Moonlight. You can see Medicine for Melancholy by the same director right now. It's streaming. You can buy it on Amazon, iTunes. So if you can't wait for another movie coming out this year, Moonlight, you can watch one by the same film director. A lovely little romantic drama, Medicine for Melancholy by Barry Jenkins. I highly recommend it. I just wanted to get a movie in there real quick while we still had some time. I can't help it.
Have a good time at the movie, Stephanie.
You too, Ewan.